So prior to this, I'll refresh just a little bit. Bruce had done Psalm 22. And then I had the couple of other Messianic Psalms. I want to cover just a couple of things that I had started with when I talked about Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. And I am going to give myself exactly 10 minutes to cover this. And that's it. And then I'm moving on from it. Bruce had this handout for Psalm 22. And it said, if Psalm 22 contains prophecy regarding the Messiah, and that prophecy was fulfilled in the life and crucifixion of Jesus, then Jesus is that promised anointed. If Jesus is the anointed, then number one, there is a God with an eternal plan for mankind's redemption. Responsibilities to the Creator and the Son are inherent in this reality. And then religions which deny Jesus as the Christ are false. And it says, for these kinds of reasons, Psalm 22 is a hinge pin upon which Christian faith swings. And for that reason, the prophecies, the Messianic Psalms, have been attacked. Because if critics of the Bible, unbelievers, can somehow undermine these Messianic Psalms, then they have a very strong argument against God, against our Bible. And so for that reason, I believe the Messianic Psalms are one of our strongest, most powerful arguments for the existence of God. For our faith, for our belief, for what we believe and what we do. I think it's extremely important. In making sort of that argument, if I can go back to it just a little bit, one of the cards that we got for discussion, for our flex class period here was for Brett to finish the class he started. And to deal with the issue of contradictory scriptures. So I want to deal with that a little bit. Number one, I don't think we have a lot of contradictory scriptures to really deal with. So now I did try to play devil's advocate just a little bit. I want to deal with that just very briefly. Do I believe in the authority, the validity, the reliability of our scriptures? Absolutely, 100% yes. No doubt whatsoever. There are some things that can make us raise our eyebrows just a little bit. I brought up the first, I believe it's 15 verses of John chapter 8, and how the earliest manuscripts of the book of John don't contain that. Now, I believe that Philip and Tom both addressed that. And I think they did so well. There are a few manuscripts that don't have that. They are the earliest manuscripts. And in textual criticism, the earliest manuscripts are considered the most valid. Now, the ones we have that don't contain those verses are just sort of oddballs. They don't fit in with everything else. So I don't think it's a massive problem, right? There are others, but they're very few. The very end of the book of Mark, if you have your Bibles, let's turn there very quick. Mark chapter 19, I believe. 16, thank you. If you go to Mark 16, probably if you have the New International Version or one of the later versions, do you have any kind of note starting there in verse 9? And it says, what does it say, your little footnote there?
It includes it, but
yes.
It's separating it from the first eight verses. It says, the early manuscript and some other ancient witness do not have Mark 16:9-10.
Okay. So, once again, that's another thing that makes us at least raise our eyebrows just a little bit. Do I think it's a huge issue? No, I don't. For a number of different reasons. Let me go into it just real briefly. A number of different reasons. Number one, I believe in the authority of the Scriptures. The Bible has been attacked the way no other ancient manuscript has been attacked, and it has stood up to these attacks over and over and over again. The other Gospels, which I believe are inspired and are absolutely reliable, contain scriptures very much like the end of the book of Mark. Right? So I take it all together. Just briefly, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls is almost complete. It's 1,000 years earlier than any other manuscripts we had previous to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is almost word for word exactly the same as what we have. So the attack, I don't know. I'm going to keep going until somebody knocks on the door. the attack that the Bible has been changed and altered all through the years has been shown to be false by the Dead Sea Scrolls. At the same time, some copies of the book of Jeremiah that were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls varied not tremendously, but significantly from the book of Jeremiah that we have today. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, do they prove the validity of the Bible, or do they prove that the Bible's been changed over time? The majority of the weight of the evidence, the data, says that it proves the reliability of the Bible. There are a few things that can be thrown in there that we kind of go, that's a little bit different. So, to me, it's very similar to this argument. We can't scientifically prove that everything in the Bible 100% the same today as it's been handed down all through the years. But nobody can prove that it's wrong. And it stood up more to these criticisms than anyone could possibly hope for. Did the Dead Sea Scrolls reveal anything that would make Christians go, wow, we got it all wrong? Were there other books that are not included in our Bible that were found that we go, ooh, we missed that one? As much as the critics of the Bible wish that it was there, that's not there. So to me, it comes down very similar to this. Critics of the Bible, let me say it this way. We want to prove that the Bible is 100% accurate. Right? It's almost impossible. Because what we're trying to prove is that there's 100% accuracy. So if they can find one small, tiny thing, then they can say, your argument falls apart. Right? To prove anything 100%, I think you're asking too much. We go back to sort of the question that Bill Nye was asking in that debate. What's reasonable? What's reasonable to believe? And to me, the weight of the archaeological evidence, the data, everything that we found, very, very strong in defense of our scriptures. Now, my whole point in making all these arguments, getting back to the Messianic Psalms, is this. If I'm going to argue against a critic of the Scriptures that is 100% accurate, all he's got to do is find one tiny thing. And while I, and anybody who's really studied it from our point of view, Tom and Philip, look at John chapter 8 or Mark chapter 16, and we are very satisfied with that, right? To them, they're not going to be satisfied with that. In no way. In no way will they be satisfied with any answer that we have to that. If we say, those manuscripts that did not include those passages were just kind of oddballs. They were stuck on a shelf. They didn't fit. Well, they come back and they say, there's earlier manuscripts and it's not in it. We're not going to convince them with that argument. That's kind of where I'm going with this. But I think that's what makes the argument about the Messianic Psalms so powerful. Because we can change that argument and say, but take a look at this. Take a look at this evidence. Take a look at this data, this archaeological evidence that we have here. Right? Isaiah chapter 53 as well. And the strength of that coming out of the Dead Sea Scrolls being compared to the modern translations that we have and being almost exactly the same. That's powerful. And there's almost no way around that. The Messianic Psalms, I think, are so strong. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. If we play that game, we can be very, very satisfied with what we find, but they will not be satisfied with our arguments. And so that's why. And they can't be, because they're looking for absolute 100%. And if they find 0.1%, then they say, ha, here it is. And we can't win that battle in that way. And so I think by using the Messianic Psalms and talking about the Messianic Psalms, we can take the argument and say, but look at this. And it's an eye opener. Tom, I've rambled on and ran over. It's something you want to say about this.
Well, one question. You're saying that because of these Psalms, they actually support the additional information that we have. Is that what you're saying?
Say it again.
You're saying that these verses and Psalms hint more at that the things that John and Mark actually did are probably more correct because they're supported by the Psalms.
I wasn't really trying to make that connection between the Psalms we're going to look at this morning and what's there in Mark 16 and John 8. I'm leaving that alone. I don't really have a whole lot to present on that, and that's not what I'm trying to. I was bringing those up as examples of, the note that I got said contradictory scriptures. So I wanted to deal with that a little bit, and I hope that I didn't present, number one, I'm not qualified, and I didn't really study tremendously to deal with sort of contradictory scriptures. I was using that more as an example of the things that a non-believer would use to attack the reliability of our scriptures. Right? And my only real point with that is, I believe the scriptures have been proven very, very reliable. But if we're trying to prove 100% and they can find one tiny thing, we're satisfied. I'm satisfied with the reliability of the scriptures. But they will never be satisfied with that. Go ahead.
Now, in that comment, the same could be said about anyone who wants to disprove the Bible.
Sure.
Want to pick on anything that's within it.
Right.
Me, if you do a study and look at these older manuscripts, there are very few.
Sure.
If you look at them, you can find discrepancies within those.
Right.
First of all, the motivation that was behind writing them, the motivation that someone would want to use these.
Right.
And why would they want to argue? And unless they want to remove these verses out of Mark 15,
right.
Which there are many denominations that would.
Sure.
Want to remove those.
Right.
And there's, I guess, an argument that saying the scriptures that were really truly accepted were copied more often. And that's why we have so many.
Right.
The other.
Sure.
manuscripts, and there is so many because they copy them so often, and that argues that there was a reason why they must have accepted them.
Right.
And also to say that the oldest is always the best is an invalid argument, in my case, I believe, only because that doesn't mean that it was accurate or taken from an accurate. And we don't know if those copies were, copied correctly to begin with. Because there are different, maybe they weren't. So that argument is just as valid as theirs, that older is better. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
I agree. It's sort of a general rule, but not an absolute under any circumstances. So getting back to that, I agree with you, and I hope I've not given any indication that I doubt the reliability of our Bible. There are some things that we can have difficulty dealing with. I agree with your arguments. But a critic of the Bible, an atheist, someone that was trying with all their heart, not just with their mind, but their heart, in approaching this with a preconceived idea that it cannot be true, they're not going to be satisfied, really with almost anything that we could present to them in these respects.
The same would apply to Bill Nye.
Yes.
Because we have paradigms and preconceived notions that we all do. Tim Hanks has the same, has that. We have that. We have biases.
Sure.
And those biases, everyone has biases.
Right.
And then it's the way that you approach and look at something. Because scientists can take the same data, and interpret it differently.
Yeah.
To fit their view. And that's why you have creationists and evolutionists disagreeing over the same data.
Over the same, right, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I said that we can't convince someone who believes in their heart, not just with their mind, but their heart. They're already going into this with preconceived ideas. So that's why I think it's so important for us to look at these messianic psalms and be able to look at someone and say, okay, let's look at the messianic psalm. Let's look at Psalm 22. Let's look at Psalm 2. Let's look at Psalm 110. Not only that, how many of them are there? And we talked some about general messianic psalm, general prophecies, and then specific prophecies. But we can look at Psalm 2. We can look at Psalm 8, Psalm 16, Psalm 22, Psalm 34, 35, 40, 41, 45, 68, 69, 109, 110, 118. The weight of it is overwhelming. It's not just a few little passages here and there. It's throughout. All the references, if you look at the two sheets that I handed out, or the two little packets I handed out, we've got 17 or 16 references from Psalm 2. It's 12 verses long. We've got 17 references from Psalm 110, which is 7 verses long. And that's just these two psalms. As we look at those two psalms, which is what we're going to do, because I've already gone over my 10 minutes. But Psalm 8 talks about Jesus being praised by children. We've looked at that one. Out of the mouth of the babes. All right? Psalm 16 talks about Jesus being raised from the dead. Right? You will not allow your Holy One to see corruption. I think that's right. 16:10. For you will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Psalm 22 we covered. Hands and feet pierced. Lots cast for his clothes. Psalm 34, we talked about that, about Jesus' bones not being broken. And that also comes from Psalm 22. I can count all my bones. And how that relates to the Passover lamb. And how we see that revealed in Jesus Christ. Psalm 41 talks about him being betrayed by a friend. Psalm 68 talks about him ascending to heaven. Another one that I came across, we looked at Psalm 90 in the very beginning, the Psalm of Moses, and just in looking over the next page over, we see Psalm 91. For he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Who quoted that in the New Testament? Satan looks at the prophecies of the Old Testament, applies them to Jesus Christ. Right? It's powerful stuff. It's powerful. It's true. It's reliable. There's no way you could make all this up. Psalm 110, of course, and then 118, which is another one of my favorites, talks about the chief building stone, and how it's rejected by the rulers, and how so much of that comes true. So let's take a look at Psalm 2, and we'll take a look at it. We talked about general prophecies, and I think this one fits more in that vein. A general prophecy would be one that could apply to the psalmist and also to the Messiah. And that's what we see here in Psalm 2. A specific prophecy would be one that could only apply to the Messiah. And that's what we see in Psalm 110 when he says, "You're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." That can't apply to David. Can't apply to David. Could only apply to the Messiah. It only makes sense after it's applied to Jesus. So let's take a look at Psalm 2 just very briefly. If you've got your handout there, it functions almost like an outline as it goes right through the... I'm sorry, I've got a couple more.
Some of those things I'll be...
Okay. So if we look at that real quick, if we look at Psalm 2, pretty easy to outline that psalm. If we look at verses 1 through 3, we see the rebellious nations on earth. Right? If we look at verses 4 through 6, we see that God rules and scoffs at them from heaven. Verses 7 through 9, God establishes his anointed one, right, to rule. And then verses 10 through 12, the rebellious king, referring back to verses 1 through 3, the rebellious kings are warned to serve God's anointed one. So let's take a look at that real quick. It really functions very good, too. When you look at 1 through 3 are on earth, 4 through 6 are in heaven, alright? The scene shifts and looks to God in heaven. Verses 7 through 9 is very much like a transition. God is still in heaven, but he establishes his decree, alright? So he takes the rule in heaven and he transfers it down to earth. And then 10 through 12 looks, focuses more earthly again as the rebellious kings are warned to worship the Son, serve the Lord, kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. So let's take a look at Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? I like the old King James Version where it says, why do the heathen rage? I like that. I like that translation. Why do the heathen rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. Why do the nations rage? Could almost be said, why do the nations even bother? Why do they even bother to rebel against the Lord? Why do they plot a vain thing against the Lord and against his anointed? This is another thing I'd like to point out about this. the anointed. The anointed one of God. That can be translated also as the Messiah. Messiah means the anointed one, and also Christ. So when we see that applied here in Psalm 2, the anointed one, that should immediately make us think about Jesus. Not explicitly stated, but Jesus, the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah. Literally, all those are translations of that word, the anointed one. So why did the heathen rage and why did the nations bother? So if we look at our handout there, the New Testament apostles come along and they rightly apply this scripture to Jesus. All right? In Acts chapter 4, verses 24 through 27, Peter and John, after they were told by the council of the elders not to preach Jesus. So after this, after they come out of that, they come back and they say this prayer all together. So when we heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, you are God who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the mouth of your servant David has said, why do the nations rage and the people plot vain things, so on and so forth. Down to verse 27 there in Acts chapter 4. For truly against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, there it is again, the anointed one, both Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together. So the apostles applied this to Jesus. Right? This psalm originally maybe was for coronation of the king. But in this general way, the apostles in the New Testament come and apply it very specifically to Jesus Christ. Why do the nations rage and why do the heathen rage and plot against the Lord's anointed? So they applied that to Jesus. And then also, if you look down throughout that handout, the rulers take counsel together. We see that over and over again in the New Testament scriptures. Matthew 12, the Pharisees went out and plotted against Jesus, how they might destroy him. Matthew 26, the chief priests, scribes, elders, and people assembled in the palace of the high priest and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. So on and so forth. You can see the references there just over and over about how the rulers plotted against Jesus, specifically against the Lord's anointed. And if y'all have any comments, feel free to step in. To me, when I studied these Psalms and saw how much they were quoted in the New Testament, the power of that was overwhelming. The center column references, if you have those in your Bible, you'll see them just over and over and over again. I'm not going to read every single thing on these handouts, but I encourage you to look them over. And as you read down through there, that's why I kind of cut and paste into this handout. Because in following from one to the next, to the next, and to the next, you feel that weight just begin to build and how strong the testimony is from the New Testament writers saying these prophecies are about Jesus Christ, very specifically. Back to Psalm chapter 2, Psalm 2, the next three verses. The scene shifts very abruptly. We've been talking about the kings of the earth and how they plot against the Lord and His anointed. Very abruptly, the scene changes now to God in heaven on His throne. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then He shall speak to them in His wrath and distress them in His deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion, God says. So the scene shifts very abruptly to God in heaven. And what is God's reaction to the nations raging? God's reaction is He laughs. Very simply. God laughs. He scoffs at the kings and at their rebellion. Then He rebukes them and He terrifies them. He speaks to them in His wrath and terrifies them in His deep displeasure. So God's reaction to these kings is very strong. And then God says, I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. In response to these nations rebelling, God makes a very strong statement. I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. God's not just sitting back and scoffing and laughing. He's doing something about it. Who's in command here? No doubt. Absolutely. No doubt about it. They're raging in vain. God says, I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. Moving on just very quickly, because I will run out of time as I always do. Verse 7. Now we begin to have sort of this transition, right? It's set up in verse 6. God says, I've set my king on my holy hill of Zion. So while the view has looked up to heaven, now God turns the view back down to earth. He begins in verse 6, I've set my king on my holy hill of Zion. And then it comes back and focuses there. I will declare the decree the Lord has said to me. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And that's brought up so many times in the New Testament. Now before we move there, let's remember the promise to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Let's look at that just very briefly. 2 Samuel 7, God has promised to David that his descendant will never cease to be on the throne. But in 2 Samuel 7 and verse 14, let me start in 13 and let me start in 12. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Sounds like Solomon, but it also sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? Verse 14, I will be his father, and he shall be my son. So, I believe that it's talking about Solomon here, but then when we apply it to Jesus Christ, it sees even greater fulfillment. The only reason I bring this up here is because we need to recognize that when he says he will be my son, that language is also applied to some of the other descendants of David, right? So that is applied to other descendants of David. And I won't go into that anymore, but what I want to say about it, really about Solomon, he said that, you know, God will call him his son. When we then see in the New Testament that it's applied to Jesus, we see that Jesus is the Son of God in a very unique way that's not applied to others. If we look down on the handout again, the Lord has said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. That's applied to Jesus. 8 times? 8 times that's applied to Jesus. It's applied to him at his baptism. We're all very familiar with that. After Jesus comes up out of the water, suddenly a voice came from heaven saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. We see that in Matthew. We see the same thing in Mark, Luke. We don't have it in John in that section. I'm sorry, when I said 9 a few minutes ago, I left out 2, 11 times. It's applied to Jesus in the New Testament. But we do have it in John 1 and verse 18. If we look there on the second page of your handout, John 1 and 18, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. Right? So this isn't just saying, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. It's taking that a little step further and saying, the only begotten Son of the Father. right? The only one, Jesus, the Son of God in an absolutely unique way, in a way that can't be applied to the psalmist or to Solomon, right? Then also Matthew 17 and 5, we switch from the baptism to the transfiguration. At the transfiguration, the same thing is said again in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And then we get down again to the very specific prophecies where Paul comes, or the very specific references in the New Testament, where Paul comes along and says, you remember when it said that in Psalm chapter 2? Well, let me tell you very specifically that that was about Jesus Christ. So that makes me stand up and pay attention even a little bit more. When a New Testament apostle says, this proves that Jesus was the Son of God, that he is the anointed one and the Messiah, then that makes me pay even more attention. And that's exactly what Paul does in Acts 13. Number one, he's in the synagogue. So he's talking to other Jews, Jews that are familiar with this psalm, familiar with this passage. And Paul uses this passage as a slam dunk home run. There's no argument against this one. Paul says, and we declare to you glad tidings, that promise which was made to the fathers, God has fulfilled this for us their children, in that he has raised up Jesus. As it is also written in the second psalm, you are my son, today I have begotten you. So the Jews there in the synagogue, they could have argued this. They chose not to. I believe that Paul's argument to them in that time was so strong, they didn't have an argument against that one. Now, I think the next Sabbath day, I believe the record in Acts 13 tells us that they came again for Paul to preach to them about Jesus. And when the Jews in the synagogue saw the Gentiles gathering to hear this word, I think it says they became jealous and they turned against Paul in that situation. But against him using Psalm 2 as proof of Jesus's being the Messiah, they didn't argue against that. I don't think they had an argument against it. Hebrews 1 and 4 uses the reference again. And in Hebrews 5:5, I liked it because it referenced both of our Psalms from today. And I've got to move if I'm going to get to Psalm 110. Hebrews 5:5 says, so also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you, from Psalm 2 and 7. And he also says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So the son and a priest. The last page there, I'm going to finish Psalm 2 just very, very quickly. Jesus has said that he will rule, take the nations of the earth for his inheritance. The figurative language of verse 8, when applied to the king of Israel, the Davidic king, that says, I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. That sort of poetic, figurative language, when applied to Solomon, he ruled the great kingdom, but not to the ends of the earth. But when it is further revealed in Jesus Christ, that figurative language becomes literal. Jesus does rule from the ends of the earth to the ends of the earth and over all nations on his throne. The language of verse 9, you shall break them with a rod of iron. That's referenced, I think, three different times in the book of Revelation, specifically in Revelation 2:27, where it says, he shall rule them with a rod of iron. They shall be dashed to pieces like the potter's vessel. And then finishing up Psalm 2, verse 10. Now therefore be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him. And I like the phrasing there in verse 11. fear, but rejoice with trembling. I don't know that I've ever rejoiced with trembling before. So there's the deep respect for the king that God has established. But then the fear there is very much a respect, because there's rejoicing that goes along with accepting the rule of God's established king. All right. Any other thoughts about Psalm 2? I ran through it very rapidly. I do encourage you to look over some of those references and see how strong they are. If there are no comments, let's move real quick to Psalm 110. I've probably got about 3 minutes to cover this, so I'll do it as best I can. Psalm 110, we go now from a general messianic prophecy to a very specific messianic prophecy. Psalm 110 is 7 verses long, and we have 17 references in the New Testament to this psalm. It's just used so much, and it's so powerful. Jesus uses it. If you go back to your handout, the Lord said to my Lord, I've already covered this before. The Lord says to, or Jesus uses this to quiet the Pharisees and to say, how is this possible that David could say this? And Jesus very specifically says that David was inspired when he said this. David in the Spirit calls him Lord. But then when we get down to Melchizedek, here was the thing I wanted to point out about that. The 3 different functions that we saw in the Old Testament were prophet, priest, and king. I believe that it was the king Hezekiah that went into the temple, who was a good king, who went into the temple and tried to present sacrifices, to burn incense before the Lord. Y'all remember that? He was a good king, but he took upon himself the role of priest. And what happened? He was struck with leprosy in the temple. The priest came in to tell him, no, you can't do that. And as they were speaking to him, and he said he was going to offer the sacrifices to the Lord, he broke out with leprosy there in the temple. The king was not allowed to take the role of priest. We see David every once in a while come close, but David never takes the role of priest, right? He organizes the temple worship, but he does not go into the temple and offer the sacrifices at the Holy of Holies. Priest and king were separate. David was a prophet. David was a king. But he was never a priest. Being a priest after the order of Melchizedek can only be applied to the Christ. And this passage is so powerful in that it references back to Genesis chapter 14. Is mentioned here in Psalm 110. And then disappears forever until the book of Hebrews comes along and explains it. And how powerful it is for Jesus to be a high priest and a king and a prophet, and to have that tested to by David. Very powerful. Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll leave this one behind. I won't bring it up again. Thanks, y'all. I believe there's no class on Wednesday night. So, because of